On the 10th anniversary of 9/11, the ambiguity of experience and memory.
A novel is a small, complicated story about the world. And the fact that it's complicated is important because it tries to be a mirror. The way I wanted to do it in this book was to highlight the ambiguity of experience and memory.
That's Teju Cole. We talk with him about his powerful and evocative novel, Open City, and fantasies of the city's destruction.
I really did think it was a series of stories that was all about attacking New York and highlighting its failures. But what I came to realize, there was also this other theme, which is a love for the city that was could only most powerfully be displayed and felt when you showed the city's disappearance.
That's Max Page. We rebroadcast my 2009 interview with him about his book, The City's End, 2 centuries of fantasies, fear, and premonitions of New York's destruction. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Teju Cole's celebrated novel, Open City, takes place in a New York City marked by the events of that day in 2001. Its narrator and protagonist, Julius, is a young Nigerian-German immigrant doing his residency as a psychiatrist at a New York City hospital. The quintessential observer, Julius takes the reader on a flaneur's journey through the city, one that is transformed through the eyes of its beholder into a place both more wonderful and more strange, a city that both embodies its trauma and transcends it. But as the novel deepens, the reader is slowly drawn into the life of the narrator himself, a life that has a mystery at its center, rooted in Julius's past. The interplay between outsider and insider, between trauma and consequence, and human connections, both acknowledged and denied, are explored in this wonderful novel, Open City. Teju Cole was born in the U.S. to Nigerian parents and grew up in Lagos. He now lives in Brooklyn. He teaches early Netherlandish art at Bard College and is writing a new book. Teju Cole, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you were born in Michigan, but you were raised in Nigeria, like your character, and live in New York again, like him. It seemed to me in reading this book, Open City, that it was a story of a man who was a bit of a stranger, a man who was an observer. I wondered if that was something that you had taken on to explore just in this book, or is this something that you yourself have experienced?
I think both of those things are true. The book is not an autobiography, but sometimes when you want to write a novel, you're containing a story between the two flaps of the covers. I feel like the best way to do that is to just take a part of reality and to explore it intensely. So, like many other people who have sort of immigrated to the U.S., I have certainly experienced isolation or loneliness or even alienation. But I wanted to explore those topics in perhaps in a deeper way than has been my own experience. I'm actually fairly comfortably integrated into my life here. Julius is very different from me in this way. He doesn't have many friends and he's quite distant from his family, but I needed to write that character that way in order to explore those things. So it's my story, but it's not my story at all.
He reminded me in some ways of Walter Benjamin's flaneur, certainly in the beginning part of the book. He begins to take long walks in the city. He's a psychiatric resident. What is the hospital?
Columbia Presbyterian, up on 168th.
So he's a psychiatric resident. He begins to take these walks throughout the city. The language was really wonderful that this book was written in, and I just wonder if you'd be willing to read a short passage that just kind of introduces us to both the language as well as a bit of his unique perspective.
Sure.
At first, I encountered the streets as an incessant loudness, a shock after the day's focus and relative tranquility, as though someone had shattered the calm of a silent private chapel with the blare of a TV set. I wove my way through crowds of shoppers and workers, through road constructions and the horns of taxicabs. Walking through the busy parts of town meant I laid eyes on more people, hundreds more, thousands even, than I was accustomed to seeing in the course of a day. But the impress of these countless faces did nothing to assuage my feelings of isolation. If anything, it intensified them. I became more tired, too, after the walks began, an exhaustion unlike any I had known since the first months of internship 3 years earlier. One night, I simply went on and on, walking all the way down to Houston Street, a distance of some 7 miles, and found myself in a state of disorienting fatigue, laboring to remain on my feet. That night, I took the subway home, and instead of falling asleep immediately, I lay in bed, too tired to release myself from wakefulness. And I rehearsed in the dark the numerous incidents and sights I had encountered while roaming, sorting each encounter like a child playing with wooden blocks, trying to figure out which belonged where, which responded to which. Each neighborhood of the city appeared to be made of a different substance. Each seemed to have a different air pressure, a different psychic weight. The bright lights and shuttered shops, the housing projects and luxury hotels, the fire escapes and city parks. My futile task of sorting went on until the forms began to morph into each other and assume abstract shapes unrelated to the real city. And only then did my hectic mind finally show some pity and still itself. Only then did dreamless sleep arrive.
Now, what is he sorting? He's just coming off from a relationship that is, if not ended, is ending. But one has a sense that he's really sorting out a whole lot more.
What interested me was the connection between the self and the society. The microcosmic personal experience and how that relates to the macrocosm of what it even means to be out in this world where others are as well. So what he's sorting is human historical experience as it is lived within the city. So he's going to places and he's seeing something of their history, something of the trace of the past in those places. But what implicitly is being solved is his own part in that. I mean, maybe the struggle of the book is to come to some kind of solution and not quite getting there, saying that this is not something you can neatly tie a bow around. So Julius is somebody in his life who is mourning various losses within the context of a society that is mourning or failing to mourn any number of losses and historical atrocities.
Yeah, in fact, you say at the end of the book, you talk about an epidemic of sorrow that is sweeping our world.
Yeah, I mean, this is Julius's point of view, and it's something that at times I share. The world can be a bright and marvelous and intricate and lovely place. And I think for Julius, even though in that passage he says that, he's also somebody who clearly takes an interest in the marvels of the world. But really, it's hard to pick up the newspaper or pick up a history book or go for a walk in a complex place like a city and not, if you're a sensitive person, feel that the dominant note is one of loss, sorrow, and futility. It's almost something like the process of evolution, which through a great deal of waste and trial and error ends up arriving at what are essentially transitory forms. So if you think about the billions of individual animals that have basically died and passed away so that what does exist today exists, it can feel like a very wasteful process.
But also there is within this, as you've just alluded to, the the working out of identity and of self-knowledge. I mean, here you have a character who is a psychiatrist in training, so he's in some way still learning his trade, paying more attention to it probably in many ways than he would have if he had already been in practice for 20 or 30 years. And he even says at a moment that he thinks that he's one of the tiny minority who thinks increasingly of the soul. I want to ask you first to say a little bit more about that, and then I'm going to ask you a question about how he sees his own soul.
Okay. Well, actually, the reason I wrote that particular part like that, his sense of even being a minority within psychiatry itself. I am not trained as a psychiatrist, but I have experience of sort of people within this profession. But I have, you know, some experience of the medical field. I was in medical school very briefly before leaving. And at the time when I was there, I actually did feel that I was in a small minority of the medical students who spent any time at all thinking about the bases of this thing that we did. For many people, it was very much about studying the material, passing the exams, becoming a doctor in that, in almost a mechanistic way. And not very many of the students thought through the philosophy or the psychology behind what it means to heal and those aspects of it. And it can be surprising sometimes to meet somebody who's working in something that you think would encourage reflection, but it turns out they take a fairly mechanistic view of it. It also happens among artists and writers, less commonly so, but it still does happen sometimes. I remember encountering a great photographer once through a film that had been made of him, his life and his work. And he turned out to be a marvelous photographer who had no kind of reflectivity about his practice as an artist. And he actually had a rather banal view of what he did. So one thing that interested me about Julius in shaping his character was about somebody who had a very high degree of awareness about his practice, about the things he did, except that there are significant blind spots in him. I wanted him to make him so sensitive as a way of pointing out that no matter how sensitive you are, you can still have significant failings of insight into your own condition.
We're talking with Teju Cole about his wonderful debut novel, Open City. Yeah, and in fact, there's a kind of ambiguous part in the book that comes toward the end where he is confronted by somebody who knew him when he was a teenager, who makes a pretty drastic accusation of him. The sense that the reader gets is that you don't really know if this has actually happened. Is this something that he just doesn't remember, that he's hiding to himself, or even that he does remember but won't admit? So this is one of those blind spots.
Yes, I mean, that's sort of the major one. The question for me was, when you're dealing with somebody who has access to words, in terms of being able to articulate his experience of the world, and who has access to thought in a layered and intricate way, how does such a person deal with something they don't want to deal with? And in this book, you know, part of what Julius is doing, certainly that incident, even though it comes as a bit as a surprise, it is foreshadowed with other things that he has sort of, on a very minor level, ignored or neglected, such as the fact, for example, that he just doesn't talk to his mother, and in fact very reluctantly talks about her. So how does a person like that deal with something they don't want to deal with? And you know, sometimes it's by simply sort of ignoring it, or sometimes it's by trying to fit it into some kind of theoretical construct, such as, you know, this idea that each person in his own life plays the hero and only the hero, and is to be sane means to have the ability not to see yourself as a villain. You know, but is that true? You know, but I was happy to leave it ambiguous because I thought that was true to the character of the story and to the character of Julius. I think it would have been false to sort of tie it up neatly because that's not at all true of his way of being in the world.
So are you saying that the reader is the one who ties that one up, that the ambiguity is something that you invite the reader to solve?
I think I want to have an act of faith in the reader, in the reader's intelligence and the reader's ability to sit with something that is not easy and not even entirely pleasant to deal with, but to say a novel is a, how would you define a novel? A novel is a small, complicated story about the world. And the fact that it's complicated is important because it tries to be a mirror into reality. And everybody does it in a different way. The way I wanted to do it in this book was to highlight the ambiguity of experience and memory. And that, after the experience is finished, that might be a little bit uncomfortable, like, oh, you know, I wish this had put me on a more even keel. But in a way, it can be a bracing thing to be knocked off center just a little bit, to be plunged into some other world and to have an experience of that world. It's this young, half Nigerian, half German psychiatrist who has these thoughts and these experiences. And to spend a few hours in his company, hopefully that adds something to the life of the reader. And that's basically all I ask for. So it's that ambiguity is both a challenge and maybe an offering to the reader that I hope that the reader can accept in the terms I've offered it.
Now, he also, this character Julius, takes a vacation to Brussels. I found this a very interesting part of the book. I've spent a fair amount of time in Holland just about the time that this visit takes place in 2006. Spent some time in southern France as well, and actually confronted much of what he is seeing, the growth of xenophobia there, which of course we also are seeing in this country as well. So it's not to say that we're blameless here, but it does seem to me that there's a difference between the way the Europeans are doing it and the way we're doing it. I'm not exactly sure what that difference is. But in any event, Julius goes there, and he meets a young man named Farouk. I found this a very fascinating relationship that develops between them, more the relationship that he has towards Farouk as he's trying to figure out who this man is and trying to, in fact, deal with some of the ambiguities that he senses. So I wonder if you could talk about this and, you know, what were your feelings in writing this?
As far as this book, at least my aim in it was to give it a somewhat placid surface because I wanted it to get into the reader in a particular way. But paradoxically, it also has so much in it that feels as if it's ripped out of the headlines. I didn't want to do that in a loud way. I wanted to present it in a sort of calm way.
In fact, it seems it's a very contemplative way. This is a meditation.
It's a meditation, but if you look at today's paper, in Europe, the EU has just sort of decided to radically change the Schengen visa agreement so that now you're going to need passports to travel between European countries. That's a big step. And they're very clear on why they've done it. Okay, so it has to do with some of the issues that were raised in this book. It's but there are two things going on there. There's a xenophobia, but at the same time, there's also the significant challenge that is posed to relatively homogeneous societies by the huge influx of non-integrating immigrants. And Julius and Farouk are sort of wrestling with this, with the ambiguities present in this thing. The relationship between them I wanted to explore, partly because I put Brussels into the book as a double of New York. Not an obvious double, but an eccentric double. in the sense that London might be an obvious double and Paris might be an obvious double. But Brussels is something else, again, that has its own problems, and yet it is also an empire state.
It's also a city where the EU is centered on the one hand, and on the other hand is experiencing almost a kind of civil war between the Flemish and the Walloons.
That's right. So you have some like the Flams Belang, which is the Flemish separatist group who are really sort of coming up in the polls, and they have this very strongly anti-immigrant, anti-Brown rhetoric. And so Julius and Farouk, in a similar kind of way, are doubles of each other. What I wanted to explore there was something I don't see enough of in fiction, which is to have two characters who are engaging each other at length, whose points of view of the world are not that far apart. I did not want to create a sort of like false dramatic contrast. In fact, I wanted it to be a little bit closer to what it is in reality, which is very often the people we're talking to are not that far from us. And yet there's still something of interest in what those differences are. So Julius and Farouk probably, maybe politically, go together maybe 80%, 90% of the way. But it's the differences that were interesting to me.
In fact, Farouk says that to us here, America is Al-Qaeda. So maybe tell a little bit about where Farouk is coming from, what his perspective is, and how that discomfits and also makes Julius think a little more deeply.
Well, I've seen in some of the response to this book, people have sort of described Farouk as an Islamic radical, you know, but I'm not sure that's a fair characterization of him. In fact, he comes across as extremely thoughtful, unlike his friend Khalil, who is a bit more hair trigger, even though Khalil also gives a persuasive account of himself and of his experiences. Farouk's experience is basically of two major forms of disappointment. One is when he was at home in Morocco, he faced political persecution and disappointment on that level. And then when he got to Europe, which he thought was, in a sense, the land of freedom and learning, he also sort of faced some pretty bruising prejudice and persecution. So he's somebody who has sort of earned the right to be disappointed. And out of that, he's trying to explain the way he views the world, which is that from a certain point of view, and I don't think it should be too controversial to say this, from a certain point of view, America is the aggressor. Just like from the American point of view, America is anything but the aggressor. America is the one who's spreading freedom and the right sorts of values. But for very, very many people in the world, it's quite the contrary. And that's an interesting paradox for any American to face. Even for an American who might think of himself or herself as being on the left, when you encounter somebody who only experiences America in one way, which is the negative aspects of American foreign policy, it can really sort of stun you into a revision of what you think about this country that you're a citizen of.
We're talking with Teju Cole about his novel Open City. Well, that reminds me, when you talked before about the microcosm and the macrocosm, I mean, here's another case where America is always the hero of its own story.
That's right. And, you know, this is a book about post-9/11 New York and post-9/11 America. And in it, it's also a book about post-9/11 Julius, you know. Both of them having so much that's going on at the same time that they are failing to deal with so much. So after 9/11, if we can be kind of what's so anthropomorphic about it, America showed a certain character that might not necessarily have been the healthiest way of dealing with it. In two ways. One, in my view, there was something of a failure of mourning, an insufficient contemplation to deal with this sort of horrible thing that had happened to us here. And secondly, there was a kind of thoughtless lashing out that not only caused a great deal of grief and sorrow to other people out there in the world, but it actually made things worse for us. We became less secure. We became less safe. I mean, I think, and now this is not Julius, but this is me, the author, speaking. I think that the most dangerous thing that has happened to America since 9/11, for me, by far, is the Bush Wars. It have made this country much less safe in the world than anything that any of our declared enemies has done. We have radicalized an entire generation of America haters. And I don't see enough of a public discourse about this, to my view, great crime that was committed against the American state by the leaders of the American state.
Yeah, even we have President Obama saying that anybody who thinks there was something wrong with going in and assassinating Osama bin Laden, as opposed to, say, capturing him and putting him on trial, should have their head examined. So right there, that it's just saying this is off the table. We are not even to think about that. What you were saying before, I think there's a connection between the lack of mourning and what followed, because when you remember back and the towers first fell, there was an outpouring of mourning to begin with, and there was some way, and people came together. People came together in this country. People came together to support this country. And so quickly that was transmuted into the enemy and us.
I mean, when you think of the people you know who have an especially difficult time mourning losses in sort of like a full and comprehensive and healthy way, it's usually those people who picture themselves as strong, you know. It's usually that this sort of narrative of men who have never cried or who refuse to ever be seen weeping because they're so tough. And again, to go back to the macrocosm, the U.S. sort of sees itself as the head of the family of the world, the father, and it has a paternalistic view at times of its role in the world. And this ends up affecting things like our ability to mourn. Because actually, part of what mourning entails is a kind of brokenness and humility. And that is almost like a river too far for us to cross, you know. We don't want to give off anything that might be seen as weakness. So the narrative around 9/11 is very much about heroism, and it's about moving on, and it's about rebuilding, and it's about vengeance. And possibly all of those things have their own place. But without coming to to terms with the fact that there are a lot of people who died, there are a lot of people who were injured, and there are a lot of people who remained fearful. There are a lot of people who were psychologically traumatized by these events and by the events that followed. Without dealing with all of that, it seems to me as if what we have now is a submerged trauma that is going to continue to express itself in a variety of morbid ways.
Well, Teju Cole, your book is Open City. It was an absolute pleasure to read from start to end, and also a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you. Thank you for your thoughtful reading of my work. Appreciate being here. Thank you.
Teju Cole is a kind of polymath. In addition to being a wonderful writer, he's a photographer and a historian of early Netherlandish art with an emphasis on Bruegel. Go to writersvoice.net to hear a web-only segment of this interview where we talk with Cole about his perspective on photography and art. Next up, we hear my 2009 interview with architectural historian Max Page about his book, The City's End. Stay tuned. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before Al-Qaeda's jets crashed into the Twin Towers in the real world, millions of players of the software game Flight Simulator had crashed their fantasy jets into the same towers for years. New York has been destroyed by flood, a sudden ice age, aliens from other planets, anarchists and immigrants, and nuclear war, all in the imagination of American writers, filmmakers, and artists. What is it about New York that excites such fantasies of destruction? That's what Max Page explores in his gorgeously illustrated book, The City's End, Two Centuries of Fantasies, Fears, and Premonitions of New York's Destruction. Page says each era has found it useful to destroy New York in its own particular way. He links fantasies of the city's end to fears about immigration, modernity, and technology, as well as a love for and homage to New York. Page teaches architectural history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Max Page, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
Did 9/11 prompt you to write this book, or had you already started on it before that?
I had started on it before that. I had written my first book had a sort of a similar title called The Creative Destruction of Manhattan, which is about how the city was regularly, normally destroyed by the workings of the real estate market and slum clearance and city planning. When I finished that book, I spoke to someone at the New York Historical Society, and I said, I have so many wonderful fictional imaginings of New York's destruction. Maybe this would make a great exhibit. That was back in 1999 or 2000. And so we talked about that, and I actually finished the proposal for that exhibition, which was supposed to be a fun, you know, fun, campy show, on September 10th, 2001.
That's really uncanny. And so, I mean, of course, your reactions were much more complicated than just thinking about the book on the day after that, on September 11th. But still, what were you thinking about your book as you watched and even videoed the towers come down?
Well, there's so many emotions and thoughts from that day. But what I had been thinking the night before about this fun show, you can imagine it, everyone sitting down at, you know, terminals and being able to play a video game or watching this series of destruction films, suddenly I felt embarrassed, as if suddenly the next day what I was doing was somehow, well, some would say almost treasonous, imagining and almost making fun of this disaster. So I really just put it aside. It was just like, this is no longer a project to undertake. But by 6, 8, 9 months later, I realized actually it was an important issue. It was important to understand not what caused 9/11, but what its meaning would be after that time.
Given what you've been writing about now all these years, the destruction of New York in the imagination, do you think that had anything to do with the choice of New York to be targeted by whoever brought down the towers, Al-Qaeda?
Well, famously, it was discovered among their belongings were flight simulator software, the Microsoft Flight Simulator, which I first used back in 1987, to fly through New York and, frankly, to fly into the trade centers. That was one of the things and I'm not the only one. I know that people all over the country, when you wanted to try out this new software back now 27 years ago, you flew to New York, and then you looked to the towers. Could I fly between them? What would happen if you hit them? So in a way, New York's importance and its continued draw for people, including people imagining its end, I think certainly influenced the choice. Since they wanted to make an impact, a political, a violent statement, they chose our, and I would say the world's still most important city and those towers, which are in some ways were its symbol.
In your book, The City's End, you say that every generation has its own reason for destroying New York. Why? First of all, why do we need disasters? And why do we need to imagine New York as the target of our disasters?
Right. Those are all the big questions I've been wrestling with. And I'll start with why New York? I mean, I think New York has been, since really the early 19th century, the nation's most important city. Even to this day, what is striking is, despite the rise of many other great cities within the United States, New York still remains kind of the center point for our economy, as we've seen in this past year, and for our culture. So that to attack New York, even fictionally, is in a way is a standard for the United States, is to attack this place. Why have we needed it? I think that to destroy the city, in New York City in particular, is to make a very strong political point about whether, and in each generation I say there was a different focus, whether it was to make a political statement or economic statement or cultural statement, but that is the most bracing way of saying this place, this civilization, has a fundamental flaw.
And yet you actually say that there are two themes, one dark, one light. The dark theme, you know, the city's destruction is our warning about some flaw in our civilization, as you just said. But you also say that the destruction of the city is a symbol of our homage and our love for the city. How does that work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did not begin this project a decade ago with that second, the lightness of this theme. I really did think it was a series of stories in film and software and poetry and music that was all about attacking New York and highlighting its failures. But what I came to realize, there was also this other theme, which is a love for the city that could only most powerfully be displayed and felt when you showed the city's disappearance. In other words, we showed fictionally, this is what we could lose. And as I say, one of the glories, especially of watching a film, is of course the lights come up. And so that's part of the release we always have, even with a kind of a horror movie or the like, is that in the back of your mind you have this tension and then a release because the lights come up and things are back where they were. That's what it was, I think, about an homage to New York.
And so in a way, what we're doing is reestablishing how important the city is to us.
That's exactly right.
In his book, The City's End, Max Page says there's long been a dichotomy between the myth of America as based in a yeoman heartland of small farmers and the reality that its history has always emerged out of great cities, with New York being one of the earliest and greatest.
That is a fundamental tension, perhaps in Western civilization, but particularly in the history of the United States, which is that in some ways it is a nation founded on cities. If you think of the Boston Tea Party and Philadelphia Independence, I mean, it's Charleston, the heart of the slave trade. I mean, it's a nation, it's an early set of colonies based on cities, but in fact, very powerful undercurrent that grows throughout the 19th century is a feeling that no, it must be a nation based in the country, on individual landholders who are independent players in this republic and not dependent people, whether slaves or workers who work in factories. So there's a very powerful tension. And in fact, one of the first great outpouring of this dystopian literature, imagining New York's destruction, I think comes in the late 19th century as New York and other cities, great industrial cities, rise and take their place as perhaps the most important centers of commerce in the country. And there's a rebellion, and part of that rebellion comes from the countryside, such as Ignatius Donnelly in his book called Caesar's Column, which was a bestseller, and it imagined how this city, because it was so unequal in wealth between the rich and the poor, between those who owned and those who worked for salaries or for pay, that this city and the civilization would collapse. It literally would just go up in flames, and there would be a column, this column created of the dead, piled high into the sky by this radical Italian immigrant. So there's a lot of racism that goes along with this movement as well, but at the heart of it was about the fear of what it would mean to have a nation of cities and a nation of people who rented and worked for pay in cities.
And talk about also the connection to vice. I mean, you talk about Tammany Hall. Tell us what Tammany Hall is and what role does that play in the imagination of those who imagine the destruction of New York?
Right. There's an undercurrent through much of the story that I tell about the fear of New York and its political corruption. Tammany Hall was the great democratic establishment, or anti-democratic, you might want to call it, that really dominated New York politics for many years in the 19th century. And there was a sense that it was, among the critics, was that it was dominated by immigrants, and it led its power by bribing these new immigrants. In other words, it was the masses were bound together, not by intelligent policies, but by bribes and the like. And so that the attack upon New York and imagining these destructive fantasies was a criticism of this runaway democracy.
So there's a conflation of prejudice, of anti-immigrant prejudice, with a concern for cleaning up, for purification of the city.
Absolutely. And there was many critics saying that there could be no other solution other than the kind of a total cleansing. I don't think there's an accident that this whole period, the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that there was a powerful sort of social Darwinist feeling, and it was quite widespread, and so that there was a sense that you needed to cleanse, literally cleanse, destroy through flame and fire the city.
And social Darwinism, the idea that the survival of the fittest, that those who are wealthy are in fact the fittest, and those who are poor are meant to die, are meant to fall away.
Correct.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Professor of Architecture Max Page about his book, The City's End. It's about how the destruction of New York has played out in the imagination, the literature, and in the culture of America. One interesting connection that you make in this early idea of the destruction of New York is the connection not only to or the critique of urbanism, but also of empire. There's a wonderful reproduction in The City's End of Thomas Cole, the artist Thomas Cole's painting, The Course of Empire. And of course, New York is called the Empire State. Why is it called the Empire State? And talk about this connection between empire and urbanism.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, New York clearly became the central economic force of the great American Empire. It had earlier been on the edge of empire, the Dutch Empire and the British Empire, and then became it grew as a great city because of the creation of the completion of the Erie Canal, which allowed New York to be the shipping point to and from the interior of the United States. That's what gave it its power, is that everything went from Buffalo over from the Great Lakes region, all the Midwest, over the Erie Canal, down the Hudson River, and then into New York's harbors and warehouses. So it became a symbol of the American Empire. I think that is one of the reasons why it continues to be the focus. If you're going to attack, make a criticism, a critique of the United States, you start with New York. And I think, frankly, I don't want to make a direct tie, but to Al-Qaeda, it's understood, or it's at least supposed, that the attack on the World Trade Center is a partly attack on the United States and its literally economic empire around the world.
And one of the earliest actual acts of destruction against New York that you speak about in the book is the 1920 bombing on Wall Street. I mean, here this powerful symbol again, the financial district. And you link this with the beginning of mass society. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the fears, or the developments that is fearful in some ways to many of those who are critical of the rise of cities even earlier, is the rise of what we call mass society, that there are products, that the identical product will be purchased in the center of New York as can be purchased in Nebraska, that is through Sears Roebuck or Montgomery Ward. There's an ongoing fear, the long-standing fear, I think, in American society that rather than be individuals, people become part of a mass, whether it's salaried workers or whether it's people watching the same television programs or later on radio and seeing and thinking the same thoughts.
But what's the connection with Wall Street precisely here? I mean, one could think of mass society as originating with Hollywood, not with Wall Street.
That's correct. I think that so many of the economic empires, whether it's in silver and gold or railroads or Wall Street, it all flowed into New York. And Wall Street became in many ways a symbol of that, the symbol of the tentacles of oligarchic capitalism, if you use the term of the day, being centered around the city. And the mansions that grew up along Fifth Avenue, which are featured in many of these books, including Caesar's Column, literally the wealth of the silver mines from Nevada flows in to those mansions. I mean, that's where the CEOs of the time lived. And so all the copper mines and the gold and Wall Street investors, it's all in New York. And so, and Wall Street, of course, is a growing symbol of this concentration of power.
Well, you pointed before to this conflation of anti-immigrant prejudice with the fantasy of the destruction of New York. And you point also, perhaps not to the idea of immigrants, but the idea of the foreigner. Superman, the Superman comics during World War II, the idea, you know, kind of the anti-Japanese. So tell us, how did the Superman comics express this fantasy of New York's annihilation?
Well, the Superman comics and then the short films that I looked a lot at in the early 1940s played on really a long-standing theme, which is the fear of outsiders, the fear of the immigrants coming and, you know, soiling the native stock, whatever that is, or just bringing their radical ideas, including the ideas of collectivism and the like.
Anarchism.
So, anarchism and the like. So you have, I mean, it's each immigrant group gets its fair share, right? The Tammany Halls, the Irish, and then you have the Italians, the fearful Caesar, the radical in Caesar's column, and then you have the Japanese, of course, in anticipation of World War II, the Germans before that in World War I, so that each time there's this fear that we are going to be invaded. The flip side of that, or the another aspect of that, is that these racial fears are stoked in order to get America to build up its military and be prepared. That phrase, be prepared, starts, you know, way back in the late 19th century, as the American economy has grown, but our military might, at least in the eyes of many, has not equaled that. And so that's the part of the push towards building up our military, World War I, before World War II, is to argue we're going to be invaded by these more powerful nations and their defective peoples.
We're talking with Max Page. He's professor of history and architecture at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Another theme you take up in The City's End is the fear of technology, that is, the impact of technology on cities like New York. For example, of course, the idea of New York being blown up by a nuclear bomb, a nuclear attack. Talk about that in this fantasy of destruction.
Yes, in the 1940s and then afterwards, the fear of nuclear annihilation dominates, obviously, the real policy discussions, but also the fictional imaginings about New York. What I argue is that New York became the way the society tried to understand the meaning of the atom bomb and the H-bomb and the impact that would have. Literally playing out, this is what Hiroshima, USA, as one article titled it, this is what it might look like. This would be the impact on our society. So to literally try to grasp what that meaning would be, you know, journalists as well as government planners played out fictions about what would happen to New York, and it had a lot of impact actually on the shape of cities afterwards.
How was that?
Well, what happened is that government officials, planners, and the like used the example of what would happen if a bomb were dropped on New York to argue for much more civil defense, argue for the highway system so that we could build suburbs and so there wouldn't be as much density. One of the biggest arguments was, look how vulnerable we are because all our economic might, all our people are in such small, dense places. We need to spread them out. And so that actually the creation of the interstate highway system and the expansion of the suburbs was in many ways a national defense policy. Partly is built on and partly is encouraged by these imaginings of, look what just one bomb dropped on New York City would do.
Now, the irony of that is that in latter-day fantasies of the destruction of New York, climate change plays a greater and greater role, and certainly we can argue a role no longer in the fantasy. I mean, this is something that you can go online and you can see under different scenarios, business-as-usual scenarios, you know, just how much of New York is going to be destroyed and even all of it could be underwater, depending on what we do to combat climate change. And it's the suburbs themselves that, of course, are partly complicit in this, given the vehicle emissions that come from our, you know, are unsustainable, spread out into suburbia.
That's correct. I would make one note, which is I was struck writing from a period, obviously the early part of this century, where climate change is so central. It's fascinating to me how often the issue of some natural disaster, and specifically climate change, plays into the fantasies well into the past. And we have this wonderful image of a glacier, a melting glacier right on Manhattan Island. This is an image from Amazing Stories, a very popular science fiction magazines in the 20s, right up through the 1950s and 60s. But there's many examples of imagining that there's some fundamental change in the natural environment. In the Twilight Zone, they play on this fantasy as well. But certainly one of the arguments is that our era is wrestling with climate change, and so that plays out in fantasies about New York. And so I think the hope among those who are making up these fantasies of New York destroyed by rising waters and the like are trying to make a political point, like Alexis Rockman, an artist who has done these wonderful murals, huge murals, imagining the city 3,000 years in the future and seeing that the waters have risen over and the city is utterly abandoned.
Yeah, describe them. They are beautiful. And you say that you say in your book, The City's End, Max Page, you say that Alex Rockman's paintings are in fact highly researched. For example, you have one which I find has a really interesting title given what we were talking about in terms of empire. It's called Manifest Destiny, and it was painted in 2004. Maybe you could describe a little bit of what we're seeing in this reproduction in your book, The City's End.
Sure. This is a 2004 mural, huge, I think 9-foot-long mural that Alexis Rockman painted. And it actually is from the Brooklyn side, or it's actually looking over to Brooklyn, interestingly. And it's describing in 5004 what the scene would be. And he really researched what scientists, in their best estimates, what would happen. And he shows that the waters have risen 85 feet near to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge towers. And then underneath the water, he shows all the kind of technologies, the nuclear subs, the oil cans and the like, that obviously we have now and that are sort of the leftovers and the cause, frankly, of this disaster. So he really looks at what might have happened. One little interesting note is he includes a bridge that has never been built. This was proposed, the Santiago Calatrava Bridge. So we have in this mural not only buildings that exist that are destroyed, but buildings destroyed that haven't even yet been built.
You know, I want to introduce something in here, and that's a very personal experience. About 10 years before 9/11, I woke up and was lying in bed, and I had a very sudden vision of the Twin Towers falling. And it was so powerful to me that, I told my friends and family about it over the years many, many times. And to me, the vision was of an earthquake, that destroyed the towers. And so when it happened, I thought, wow, I must have in some way, seen what was going to happen, had a sense of what was going to happen. But after reading your book, Max Page, after reading City's End, I thought, well, maybe not. Maybe this wasn't a psychic ability on my part, but that it was just part of this kind of cultural psychology that we are all part of, kind of that Jungian, what did Jung call it, the collective unconscious of those of us who are connected to that city.
Well, it may also simply be that without knowing it, you were seeing some of the cultural artifacts. I mean, there were comic books, there were films from the moment the World Trade Center towers, not even when they were completed, already before they were completed, there were already imaginings of it falling down. In 1979, there was Meteor, which imagine a meteor bringing them down. There were comic books and the Fantastic Four. There's been many examples of this from the moment they were under construction. So whether or not you actually purchased those books or saw those movies, it was part of the culture. In fact, there's a famous line that I'm trying to remember who said it. It said, "There's the moment a building goes up, we already imagine its destruction."
And what is that about?
I think there is, the skyscrapers are the great symbol of the 20th century, the great symbol of human technological and mastery, literally over gravity, and yet so that I think there's always a sense that, in fact, perhaps this experiment will fail. The worry, the fear that, in fact, what we are creating is not permanent. We know it's ultimately not permanent.
It's almost, it's a modern-day Icarus story. The story of Icarus who flies too close to the sun. Here, I mean, it's a really very ancient meme, the idea of human technology, the human ingenuity being destroyed by its own hubris. I mean, you could talk about original sin and the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden.
That's correct. I accept that. I would argue that building those skyscrapers, I wouldn't call it inevitable at all. As a historian, I would never call anything inevitable, but there was a powerful investment in it. It was a powerful meaning attached to it. I would argue that the great artists and writers and inventors that came out of New York, partly what inspired them, what has made New York so great, is these great buildings and skyscrapers. That is part of the sense of this is a uniquely powerful spectacle. And this inspires people as well. So it is great hubris, but it is also inspiring.
Is there one image above all that strikes you, that moves you, that you came across and that you used in this book?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and it's one type of image. That is the image not of the city physically destroyed, where the buildings lie in ruin or they've exploded in nuclear holocaust, but rather a lone person running through the empty streets. So there are no people there, but the buildings are all intact. There's just one person. And that could be Vanilla Sky with Tom Cruise. There's The World, the Flesh, and the Devil with Harry Belafonte. There's any number of fantasies that really cut to the core of me, because what it said was the city is nothing without the teeming masses of people rushing through the streets and the subways, and that the most awful thing is to see these glorious buildings empty and devoid of all the people and all the life and culture and economic life and strife that they bring. That is really what makes the city great.
Well, Max Page, your book is The City's End. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Max Page teaches architecture and history at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. In addition to The City's End, he's also the author of The Creative Destruction of Manhattan. And to explore more about The City's End and to see some of the images that the book reproduces, go to writersvoice.net. Max Page teaches history and architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Go to writersvoice.net to see images from The City's End. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net. To find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.